This is KHBR, the voice of darkness for the intrepid travelers of the left-hand path. I'm Magister Robert Adams, your host. We'll be accompanying you on your journey. So get ready, sit back, relax, and prepare to kefir and remanifest. Welcome to KHPR, the voice of darkness. I'm Robert Adams, your host, and on this, the last day of 2010, we have one last show before we start the new year. This lecture was given by Magister Doug Pridgen at the previous Temple of Set's conclave this year and is called Regarding Oneself in the Cosmos, Rational Ethics as the Guide to Well-Being. I hope you enjoy this lecture, and there will be more to come in 2011.
To live a truly fulfilling life requires a personal code of values for directing choices, finding purpose, flourishing, experiencing happiness, and achieving a sense of well-being. Determining values requires a standard of evaluation, an end that is not a means to some other end, the identification of an end in itself. This end in itself is life, and it is your life in particular. Evaluation requires skill in the art of proper inference. Good thinking informs good behavior. For centuries, it has been assumed and argued that morality is grounded in faith, an assertion of absolute conviction that is assumed independent of evidence and which must be defended against all evidence to the contrary, and that an external authority, usually supernatural, such as a god or its inspired text, is required to cow humans into behaving like ladies and gentlemen. Speaking for the devil pro bono, I contend that reason and faith are mutually exclusive, that reason is the proper guide in making ethical decisions, and that faith is the root of fear, divisiveness, ignorance, and intolerance. Far from being its source, faith abdicates morality and personal responsibility entirely. In short, I contend that life is the highest value and that reason, the gift of Set, is the highest virtue. Virtue meaning that by means of which values are achieved. This is a quote from Ayn Rand. There has never been a philosophy, a theory, or a doctrine that attacked or limited reason, which did not also preach submission to the power of some authority. Philosophically, most men do not understand the issue to this day, but psycho-epistemologically, they have sensed it since prehistoric times. Observe the nature of mankind's earliest legends, such as the fall of Lucifer, the light bearer, for the sin of defying authority, or the story of Prometheus, who taught men the practical arts of survival. Power seekers have always known that if men are to be made submissive, the obstacle is not their feelings, their wishes, or their instincts, but their minds. If men are to be ruled, then the enemy is reason. End quote. Arise thus in your glory, behold the genius of your creation, and be prideful of being. For I am the same, I who am the highest of life. There are crucial moments in the history of ideas when a shift in orientation is required. For example, although the notion of a solar system had been proposed in the 6th century BCE by Pythagoras, the majority of people, due primarily to the influence of Aristotle, ultimately accepted the geocentric theory of the cosmos, the notion that the sun, moon, and planets revolved around the Earth. In 1543 CE, Polish astronomer Nicholas Copernicus first proposed his heliocentric theory, which was further developed, refined, and published in his book On the Revolution of the Celestial Spheres. In time, the heliocentric theory proved itself the better explanation and replaced the geocentric theory. Such an outer or exoteric orientation may ultimately reflect a cognate inner or esoteric shift in consciousness. This seems plausible as the esoteric tradition evident in our oldest religious iconography and mythology is stellar. This gradually shifted towards a lunar and eventually a solar orientation, both of which are also reflected in the religious iconography and mythology of their respective times and places. To be clear, these transitions can also be understood as attempts to expand and refine the initial insight, and it is somewhat misleading to draw sharp distinctions as to when these shifts occurred. The fact that there is a great deal of overlap in these transitions also cannot be ignored. The notion of esoteric shifts in consciousness influenced the Victorian magician Aleister Crowley and was incorporated into his conceptualization of eons, an idea initially introduced to him in a book by Florence Farr titled Egyptian Magic. For Crowley, these esoteric shifts came full circle in 1904 CE when he transcribed the Book of the Law in Cairo. The ideas expressed in this book stand or fall on their own merit, whether the claim of transcription is accepted or not. The central theme is that of a return to the stellar orientation of consciousness. Stated plainly, this stellar orientation has as its focus the enlightened individual in opposition to an external authority, whether divine or human. This is the basis of thelema, or true will, and its law, do what thou wilt. In this, the influence of freethinkers from Rabelais to Nietzsche is also evident, most notably the latter's announcement of the death of God and the revaluation of all values. It is possible that Crowley intended to style himself a heterodox Saul of Tarsus to Nietzsche's Antichrist, while outwardly acknowledging himself the great wild beast. There is no contradiction in this, as the beast is an office and not an individual, an office that would later be assumed by another magician named Michael Aquino. Perhaps the most crucial aspect of these shifts in consciousness involves how individuals are to regard themselves and, as a corollary, how they are to conduct themselves in affecting the environment, their own species, and other species. This is the content or subject matter of that central branch of philosophy called ethics. Ethics doesn't just concern itself with how we should behave in relation to each other, but how we should approach life generally, what role we are to assume as responsible agents in a cosmos that is predominantly lifeless and indifferent to our presence or survival, much less anything beyond that. The primary task in ethics is for the individual to determine and prioritize a hierarchy of values. Quote, a code of values to guide man's choices and actions, the choices and actions that determine the purpose and the course of his life, unquote. That's from The Virtue of Selfishness by Ayn Rand. The shift in orientation announced in the Book of the Law is referred to as the Aeon of Horus. An aeon is a concept rooted in Gnosticism, a loosely organized religious and philosophical movement that flourished in the 1st and 2nd centuries CE. This term also is used in the Temple of Set to refer to the shift that occurred in 1975 CE, the year 10, which resulted in the reconsecration and the coming into being of the Aeon of Set. According to the Setian theory, previous eons persist and are not altogether abolished at the inauguration of a new one. The more refined and exclusive the shift in consciousness, the less people are willing or able to orient and align themselves to it. The most pernicious remnant of the Aeon of Osiris, which operates according to the formula of the dying god, is its ethical code of altruism. This is the ethos perpetuated by the Abrahamic religions, and the false dichotomy inherent in it was first identified and opposed by the Russian philosopher Ayn Rand. Born on February 2, 1905 CE, Rand was a child of the Aeon of Horus, and her philosophy had a tremendous influence on Anton LaVey, as is evident in the 9 satanic statements of the Satanic Bible. Oddly enough, Rand's ethical theory of rational self-interest was not a significant influence on LaVey, as the Satanic Bible derives its ethos from Ragnar Redbeard's Might is Right and from the Christian Bible Old Testament edict of an eye for an eye. Unfortunately, this diagnosis treats only a symptom of altruism and fails to identify or deal with its root cause. It is because of this that the logical fallacy is neither identified nor dealt with by LaVey. What is this dichotomy? Altruism is based on the false premise that humans are inherently hostile towards one another. It is from this falsehood that the dichotomy arises. Offering an alternative between either exploiting and victimizing others, which it defines as evil, or allowing others to exploit and victimize you, which it defines as good. There is a third possibility that is conspicuously absent from this dichotomy. Avoidance of having to choose between false alternatives necessitates a rejection of the notion of sacrifice entirely. In a functional, healthy, and harmonious relationship, there are no victims. The formula of the dying God fails. Both Crowley and Rand highlight this point in slightly different ways. Crowley states that individuals doing their true will cannot come into conflict with one another, while Rand maintains that the interests of rational men do not clash. To achieve and maintain values requires both a means of evaluation and a standard of value or end in itself. The fundamental choice being life or death, it is life that emerges as the standard, and all lesser values are prioritized accordingly. Or, as LaVey put it, life is the great indulgence, death the great abstinence. Focus on an afterlife or death worship devalues this life in the same way that selflessness, because of the inherent contradiction in that concept, renders love impossible. Altruism is not compassion, and it is not concern for the well-being of others. Altruism involves placing the interests of others above your own interests and actively hinders compassion or concern for others. Think of, for example, what it would mean to have no personal interest in the object of your affection, your love interest, the notion of selfless love, quote unquote. Such a notion serves only to devalue and undermine the experience of romantic love. Would your beloved feel flattered or consoled if you told them that you love them in spite of any admirable qualities or virtues they may possess? That you love them for their own sake as a disinterested act of self-sacrifice? In this context, sacrifice means to give up a greater value for a lesser value or for a non-value. To refer back to a faith-based authority, which motive represents the moral high ground? Helping someone out of a genuine concern for their well-being or because a celestial mafia boss will reward or punish you accordingly? Motivated by a subconscious death wish, this second choice leads to the exploitation and victimization of others, resulting in an empty and tortured span of years ending in self-annihilation. Short-sighted ignorance will not shelter the unjust or the vicious from this ultimately inescapable fate. It should be clear that the only that only rational self-interest can provide a legitimate standard for evaluating and pursuing ethical goals. Avoiding death is not the same as achieving life. Richard Dawkins makes this point beautifully and ironically, quote, "We are going to die, and that makes us the lucky ones. Most people are never going to die because they are never going to be born. The potential people who could have been here in my place, but who will in fact never see the light of day, outnumber the sand grains of Sahara. Certainly those unborn ghosts include greater poets than Keats, scientists greater than Newton. We know this because the set of possible people allowed by our DNA so massively outnumbers the set of actual people. In the teeth of these stupefying odds, it is you and I, in our ordinariness, that are here. We privileged few who won the lottery of birth against all odds. How dare we whine at our inevitable return to the prior state from which the vast majority have never stirred." End quote. It is living life on one's own terms and not life per se that is the highest value. Socrates is reported to have said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Also, "We must value most not living, but living well." From the former statement, we can properly infer that by living well, Socrates is referring to a life guided by reason. To illustrate, is not living with a terminal illness while suffering needlessly just that, needless suffering? Once again, we inherit a doctrine of cruelty, a remnant of faith so deeply ingrained in society that most of us take for granted the notion that it is not our place to have any say in how or when we die. If you think carefully about it, the reason behind declaring suicide a sin becomes clear. If it were not, then people believing in a doctrine of life after death would be quite anxious to be on their way to paradise. If Islam lacked the belief that martyrdom overrules the sin of suicide, we might have been spared the tragedy of 9/11, when, as Sam Harris so eloquently phrased it, 19 pious men showed our pious nation just how socially beneficial religious certainty can be. It is the achievement of that which is most valuable, your life, that your highest moral purpose is attained, happiness, flourishing, and a sense of well-being. Rational self-interest, or eudaimonism, is rooted in ancient Greek thought and consists of several components which, in and of themselves, are necessary but not sufficient to its realization. A delineation of these is forthcoming, but first I would like to address two ethical dilemmas. The first is an issue that must be addressed by the eudaimonist, the second by the theist. Ought from is. The first of these, Hume's guillotine, is a rather ivory tower concern. You'll see what I mean by this in due course. Hume's argument is that no description of how the world is can lead to a prescription of how one ought to act. To quote Hume, "In every system of morality which I have hitherto met with, I have always remarked that the author proceeds for some time in the ordinary ways of reasoning and establishes the being of a god, or makes observations concerning human affairs, when all of a sudden I'm surprised to find that instead of the usual copulations of propositions is and is not, I meet with no proposition that is not connected with an ought or an ought not. This change is imperceptible, but is, however, of the last consequence. For as this ought or ought not expresses some new relation or affirmation, necessity dictates that it should be observed and explained, and at the same time that a reason should be given for what seems altogether inconceivable, how this new relation can be a deduction from others which are entirely different from it." End quote. It is certainly true that there is no ought for inanimate matter. Ethics is irrelevant to non-life. Further, ethics isn't even necessary to all life. It is only necessary to organisms possessed of a rational faculty or sapient, self-aware life. Sapient beings are free to reject the way things are, to act within the range of possibilities open to them, to need, to desire, to make choices, and to reshape the environment in accord with how they think it ought to be. Were that not the case, we'd still be living in caves. The fact that I am able to think rationally and conceptualize enables me to envision an ought and take the actions required to make that vision a reality. Ethics is an if-then discipline. To live consistently as a rational being requires informed actions as opposed to blind chance, whim, impulse, instinct, faith, etc. The fact that we are fallible necessitates the central role of reason in determining what we ought to do. The self-correcting method of reason is the means by which we derive an ought, a maximally beneficial course of action from that which is. the situation in which we find ourselves. This is why reason is the highest virtue. What one ought to do is contingent upon an aim or goal. To qualify as objective, rooted in reason, that aim or goal must be rationally justifiable within the context of a given situation. Living an examined life, a life guided by reason, is the only way to make informed decisions. Sapience being our distinguishing characteristic as a species, to be guided by an irrational or non-rational faculty would be to live in contradiction to that definitive trait. To make the point explicitly, it is the unnaturalness of our nature, what we are, that determines how we ought to live. The Euthyphro dilemma. In the Platonic dialogue Euthyphro, Socrates poses an important question. Is an act good because the gods command it, or do the gods command an act because it is good? This question has embarrassing implications for monotheists. If an act is good because God commands it, the implication is that the good is a matter of divine fiat, making it contingent and therefore arbitrary. Whereas if God commands an act because it is good, the implication is that God is subject to something greater, the good, which rules out the possibility of his alleged omnipotence. Earlier I spoke of the components required for the realization of eudaimonia. Here I will examine each of these in turn, beginning at the level of sensation and working my way up the Platonic scale to levels of increasing abstraction. Soma, the physical. It is our biological function to take in nourishment, to grow, and to reproduce. Nourishment, growth, and reproduction are therefore the base values reality has set for us to pursue. If we fail in this pursuit, we perish, both individually and as a species. At this level, values are equivalent to needs. It should therefore come as no surprise that evolution by natural selection is a contributing factor to our behavior as social animals. Non-sapient life doesn't have the option to premeditate and subsequently act to bring about its own destruction. For non-sapient life, survival is instinctive and automatic, which is why ethics as such is a non-factor. Ethics is exclusive to beings able to evaluate and choose in the face of alternatives. In taking a look at our closer relatives, we observe that chimpanzees are moved to reconcile and confront and comfort one another after disputes. Although they are unable to swim, chimpanzees have been known to die saving other chimpanzees from drowning. They also react negatively to situations they perceive as unjust, such as the unequal rationing of food. In another example, rhesus monkeys have been known to starve themselves for days to avoid taking food by pulling a chain that sends an electrical shock to another monkey. This preparation by nature provided Set with the opportunity to alter us genetically. Through the creation and development of language, we afford ourselves the means required to raise these adaptive behaviors to a level of explicit conceptual awareness. Four particular behaviors are at the base of our social interactions: empathy, reciprocity, peacemaking, and the ability to learn and follow rules. With the emergence of Homo sapiens sapiens, must be added two additional levels of refinement. First is the social enforcement of ethical imperatives through reward, punishment, and prestige. Second is a degree of evaluation and cognition that is without parallel in other species. Only sapient beings are able to codify ethical guidelines aimed at the deliberate pursuit of values. It is through the gift of Set that we inherit the psychology of our possible evolution. Thumos, the emotional. Emotional bonds are vital to our happiness and well-being. Sam Harris argues that the chief concern of ethics is to increase happiness and diminish suffering. To this end, it is empathy and compassion that motivate us to assist those who are less fortunate than ourselves. This tendency is apparent in 18-month-old toddlers who will spontaneously move to comfort someone who appears upset. Emotions are also indicators of success or failure in the pursuit of values. The sense of pride and well-being we experience in productive work in a job well done, or the displeasure and distress at impediments to our designs are obvious examples. The origin of the concept work ethic should be clear in this regard. Noose, the intellectual. The intellect is the greater black magical working of Set on this planet. Because there is no absolute, unchanging, infallible, one-size-fits-all blanket answer to all of life's problems, the necessity of rational guidance is clear. Right thinking requires skill in the art of proper inference. Without logic, there is no way to distinguish correct from incorrect reasoning. In ethics, a value is an end, goal, or telos, and a virtue is a means to that end, that by virtue of which a worthy goal, a value, is achieved. As the number of moral dilemmas is potentially infinite, a contrast and comparison between the virtues contingent upon reason and the vices rooted in faith should prove instructive in approaching these issues and avoiding potential pitfalls. The following virtues are the progeny of reason: ignorance as the first instance of self-awareness and the initial spur to seek the mysteries. The need to continually expand and refine tentative knowledge as more information and insight become available. The need to integrate this information and insight into a coherent and meaningful context. The need for self-integration, pursuit of well-being, flourishing, and happiness. The arrogance of faith is demonstrated when a faith adherent, being certain in their convictions, leaves no room for doubt and shuts a door which, if left open, provides opportunities to correct errors, build horizons, and achieve knowledge. Faith doesn't just retard progress, it stops progress dead in its tracks. The following vices are the offspring of faith: certainty as the first instance of self-delusion and the initial impediment to seeking the mysteries. The desire to reduce information and insight to a least common denominator, limiting horizons while retarding progress. The desire to ignore information that doesn't fit with preconceived notions and unwarranted assumptions. The pursuit of disintegration, self-destruction, deterioration, and suffering. Next is the daimonic level, the spiritual. Man is a physical being. Man is an emotional being. Man is a rational being. Harmonious relations between and among these parts results in the daimonic, an emergent property expressive of the indwelling essence that is the gift of Set. My teacher once told me that ethos is daimon, character is destiny. The fact that initiation makes the initiate stronger without improving character points to the crucial role a code of ethics ought to play in the pursuit of Kefir. In conclusion, I would like to quote the last paragraph of the foreword I wrote for Dr. Velman's book, Theurgy and Numbers. What is theurgy? The word is Greek and translates into English as divine work. This tool can be used for good or ill, to aspire to the highest and best, or to surrender one's intellectual autonomy, to come into being or to merge with the all. Pakerbeth, which means to rise up to and embody a divine state, is a formula in the Greek magical papyri and is derived from the Egyptian Paker Neter, which translates to working as the god. The essential identity of these concepts with that of theurgy are obvious to the insightful. The perspective and aims presented in this book are those of the left-hand path, and it is within this context that the divine work of Thurgi is intended to operate.
You've been listening to KHPR, The Voice of Darkness. If you have any questions or comments, you can email them to us at khpr@keffer.org. Thank you for listening, and we hope that we've been able to bring about some change for you.
I'm fucking Ozzy Osbourne, the Prince of fucking Darkness.
Evil, evil, but fucking evil.
There can be only one Prince of Darkness.
And that would be me, Robert Adams.